You were taught that Abe Lincoln freed the slaves. What if he didn't? Time to rethink teaching history. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slacker. Here's what's trending in education news.
From NPR.org, South Dakota public schools add "In God We Trust" signs to walls. Public school students in South Dakota will notice something different on their first day back to school. The national motto, "In God We Trust," prominently inscribed on walls in stencil or in paint.
Well, that's good that we trust in God. As you walk.
Gotta trust in someone.
I don't know. I mean, as students continue to enter their buildings, it's getting a bit of a problem. You know, to who should you trust? The issue here is, and the way NPR frames this right off the bat is the national motto, "In God We Trust."
Right.
Okay. So there's nothing wrong with that, to put the national motto up in schools. Because it's the national motto. It's not promoting God, because
correct.
Our national motto in the United States already promotes God.
Correct.
Except it gets a little bit funky when you start getting into, quote, public education and public schools and the separation idea of church and state. And is this a violation of a public institution promoting a belief in God?
Well, then here's my question.
Because what if I walk in the door and I don't trust in your God?
But if this is the national motto of the United States,
mm-hmm.
why does the issue always come down to, oh, you're putting it in my face and I don't want to see it? Why isn't it, hey, let's change the national motto?
That's a good point. I'm all for changing the national motto.
Because, you know,
in guns we trust.
Well, in something.
Yeah, well, anyway.
But do you know what I mean?
It's
like, because if that is our national motto, and school students
there's nothing
are seeing
wrong
it
with
and they're learning
it
about it, then, well, we should put it up.
Okay, now here, though, if you look at the picture here, which the listener can't see, it just says, "In God We Trust." Now, if it was followed with, "This is our national motto, it was put together by so-and-so in such and such and such a date," and now, however, you should also know that in today's age, some people have a problem with it. Okay, now we're going to learn about our national motto? Okay, I'm with you. But a big, as I walk in the door in black and white, truly.
Literally.
"In God We Trust." I'm like, oh, isn't that trying to tell me something? Is that really trying to teach me about the national motto? Or is that trying to tell me that in this place, God rules, damn it?
From Bloomberg.com, testing craze is fading in U.S. schools. Good. Here's what's next. New ways to measure student progress are gaining ground. Wind turbines, anyone?
You know, when I saw this headline,
yeah,
I was really happy.
I know.
It's like, oh my God,
cool.
Really? The testing craze is going away, because anybody who knows has been following anything I've done. Mr. Opt-out, I hate tests.
Right.
Okay? So coming across with such a headline like that, I'm like, yes.
It's about time.
It's about time. And then I was like,
wait.
But where? And they give us a couple places, but I kind of went personal then. And I was like, so me right now, my daughter, who's going to be a junior,
mm-hmm.
nothing has told me that anything that's going to happen to her this school year is going to be anything other than testing. And that wind turbines might be something she takes a look at, but it's not going to be used to assess her knowledge of physics the way this article talks about alternative assessments. So I'm skeptical about this hopeful title.
It seems very genuine, too, like everybody's dropping it, and here's the new wave that's coming.
It's a hula hoop. Everybody's got to have one. Everybody's, no one's doing that testing thing anymore.
Why
that's
would you
so
do that?
Last week, you
let's
know.
Let's make things
let's do alternative assessments. Let's actually see, you know, can you understand what it means to test the flow of water without actually having it written out. And instead, we're going to create a water flow and we're going to do all right. those. Right. It's called, I love that they call it alternative assessment as opposed to authentic assessment. There is a mention of authentic, but yeah, right. Let's really see if Bonnie knows what she knows. And the way we're going to see if Bonnie knows what she knows is she's going to do the thing she says she knows.
A real world proof. Instead of
right.
filling
instead
out
of a testing
tests on
craze,
a page. Yep.
Right. Because we know the test and you getting a right answer on the test may not have anything to do with the fact that you actually know what you're talking
right.
about. Right. Okay?
Fill in C.
And,
just yeah. fill in C.
And largely the testing craze has in fact even produced some of the worst learning situations that we can in order to pump up test scores. So again, love the article title, hoping that I'd actually get to see some of that. But I'm telling you, in Wisconsin, and then I went and put it on Busted Pencils Facebook page, and I got a ton of people going, I don't see it. Where's this happening? Oh, Wyoming. Really? Is Wyoming, how many, there's like 13 people in Wyoming. So I don't know that it was that effect, you know. But, you know, particularly here in Wisconsin, there's no, like there's not been any major announcement that the Wisconsin, whatever exam we're giving next year, because in Wisconsin, we like to give it a new name every year.
Yeah.
There's not been an announcement that it's gone away. So in Wisconsin, the testing craze, it seems here to stay.
From NPR.org, South Dakota Public Schools add In God We Trust signs to walls. Public school students in South Dakota will notice something different on their first day back to school. The national motto, In God We Trust, prominently inscribed on walls in stencil or in paint.
Well, that's good that we trust in God. As you walk.
Gotta trust in someone.
I don't know. I mean, as students continue to enter their buildings, it's getting a bit of a problem, you know, to who should you trust?
Just trust the issue.
So, right, the issue here is, and the way NPR frames this right off the bat is the national motto, In
right.
God We Trust.
Right.
Okay. So, there's nothing wrong with that, to put the national motto up in schools. Because it's the national motto. It's not promoting God, because
correct.
Our national motto in the United States already promotes God.
Correct.
Except it gets a little bit funky when you start getting into, quote, public education and public schools and what you know the separation idea of church and state. And is this a violation of a public institution promoting a belief in God?
Well, then here's my question.
Because what if I walk in the door and I don't trust in your God?
But if this is the national motto of the United States,
mm-hmm.
why does the issue always come down to, oh, you're putting it in my face and I don't want to see it? Why isn't it, hey, let's change the national motto?
That's a good point. I'm all for changing the national motto.
Because, you know,
in guns we trust.
Well, in something.
Yeah, well, anyway.
But do you know what I mean? It's like, because if that is our national motto, and school
then
students
nothing
are
wrong
seeing
with
it, and
putting
they're
it
learning
up.
About it, then well, we should put it up.
Okay. Now, here, though, if you look at the picture here, which the listener can't see, it just says, In God We Trust. Now, if it was followed with, this is our national motto, it was put together by so-and-so in such and such
right.
and such a date. And now, however, you should also know that in today's age, some people have a problem with it. Okay. Now we're going to learn about our national motto? Okay, I'm with you. But a big, as I walk in the door in black and white, truly.
Literally.
In God we trust. I'm like, oh, isn't that trying to tell me something? Is that really trying to teach me about the national motto? Or is that trying to tell me that in this place, God rules, damn it? He's taught high school social studies in Portland, Oregon, and New York City for the last 7 years. He recently moved to Philadelphia, where he will, ironically, be teaching at Abraham Lincoln High School. You'll catch that in a little bit. This upcoming school year, he is an editor of Rethinking Schools, a teacher leader with the Zinn Education Project, focused on their Teach Reconstruction campaign, an editor of Teaching a People's History of Abolition and the Civil War, published by Rethinking Schools in March this year. Welcome to Busted Pencils, teacher, editor, author, awesome dude, Adam Sanchez.
Thanks for having me.
So why is it ironic that you're teaching at Abraham Lincoln High School?
Good question. I think it's a little bit ironic. I mean, but in terms of the book that was just published in March, Teaching the People's History of Abolition and the Civil War, what the book attempts to do is really challenge what is the commonplace myth I think most students certainly have come into my classroom with, which is Abraham Lincoln freed the slave.
Right. The great emancipator. So right away, right off the bat, you're going to go and blow up white people's history. Thank you. You know, come on. I mean, there was only one good white guy left in the American canon, and you just blew him up.
Well, I think, you know, on the one hand, I do think it is important for students to see that Lincoln changed, right? That
right.
He did move quite a bit his position on slavery. You know, we start with his, in my class, we start with his first inaugural speech where, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but Lincoln essentially says, hey, South, stop freaking out. I never said in any of my published speeches that I would get rid of slavery where it exists. And, you know, I'm going to quote, you know, from a speech right now that to reemphasize that, that I have no intention of doing so, and I don't believe I have any lawful right of doing so. So he goes from that, his first inaugural speech, to his second inaugural speech, where he's essentially saying it's God's will to liquidate the slave-owning class, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is, you know, the second inaugural speech, of course, is where the great emancipator comes from. But the question that the book raises and that I want to raise with my students is what happens in those 4 years in between those speeches that pushes Lincoln to a much more radical position? And you can't understand that without understanding the massive abolitionist movement, without understanding the actions of enslaved people themselves.
Yeah, that's, I mean, so putting that, as you just did, and this is so wonderfully in that great context of understanding how this person made this move, and not just over those 4 years, been what went into this, but when you talk about the abolitionist movement itself, as a past social studies teacher, we mention a couple key abolitionists, boom, move into Lincoln was elected, boom, the Emancipation Proclamation, slaves are freed, move on to Reconstruction, and let's move on. You know, that's kind of the quick and dirty, and that's how we teach it. And of course, you know, when you put this in the introduction, that this is the typical response of the students that you have in your class, I would say, I bet anybody who teaches this would agree that, yeah, that's what, if they have any sense of Lincoln in the Civil War and the abolitionist period, it's a really quick snapshot of, hey, abolitionists kick some butt, Lincoln freed the slaves, and we moved on.
Right. And I think, of course, what this does is set students up for misunderstanding how social change happens in this country, right? And it's why, to this day, so many people look to the top, right? Look to what is happening in the White House, who's sitting there, what is happening in the halls of Congress. And not to say that that's not important, but that there's a misunderstanding of how real serious social change has happened in this country. It's almost always happened because people at the bottom have pushed it to happen, whether it's the abolitionist movement, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the LGBT movement, et cetera. Change rarely happens in this country without people organizing on a mass scale.
Yeah, so I'm just going to quote and read directly from the introduction of the book, and you just laid this out, so it's a little bit of a repeat, but quote, how does major social change occur? And I love that idea, first of all, thinking that, hey, we're going to teach students from that perspective, and you're like, what is the relationship between those at the top of society, presidents, Congress, elites, and ordinary citizens? What kind of power do, quote, leaders have? What kind of power do we have? What role have black people played in fighting for their own liberation? What role have white people played in maintaining and fighting black oppression? Can social movements make a difference? How can we learn from the past to influence the future? Now, this is where you and me, I agree, the actual process of teaching history coming from this is that we look at it and say, the reason we're doing this is to influence social change and move towards the future. What about somebody who says, Adam, just the facts, man. Don't be influencing the students.
Well, I mean, first I would say that this book is about teaching the facts, right? It's about, you cannot understand how Lincoln changes his position so drastically without understanding the thousands and thousands of slaves, enslaved people that were running away during the Civil War and running away into the Union Army, and so forcing the Union Army to make a decision. Are you going to return these people to their so-called masters, or are you going to free those people, right? So the enslaved people themselves raised the political question and forced the politicians to answer it. And so, when we're talking about teaching the facts, like, that is an essential fact. You cannot understand the Emancipation Proclamation without understanding that fact. And so I think that's part of it. And then also, I think we do have to say that teachers need to be able to teach beyond just the facts. We need engaged citizens, right? We desperately need engaged citizens right now. People need to know how, students need to know and feel empowered so they can act in their own communities to make our country, to make our communities better places. And so I think we also, at the same time, while saying, yes, we do need to teach the facts, we also have to fight for the right to empower our students to be engaged citizens. If not, what is social studies for?
Exactly. If anybody reads John Merrow, a longtime 40-year reporter for NPR, just put out an article yesterday about really questioning the idea, have schools failed in this realm of citizenship? And social studies teachers across would say, our engagement in social activity at the smallest level is horrendous, but yet for big picture issues like this, it's even more lacking. And what you're talking about here in the book, and we're going to jump into that, though, is to say we have, in fact, using this moment in time in history, let's talk about the real issues here that actually show real people engaging in real action, pushing the government in a direction and showing the fact that, yes, as an active participant, you as an individual citizen, even as an oppressed person, can push those levers of power sometimes with a great collective move. And so here in the book, why we need, so in your introduction, we just talked about this, why we need a people's history of abolition in the Civil War. But the book's organized around, hey, you're a teacher, 10 lessons. Right. And so lesson one, Frederick Douglass fights for freedom. Do we learn more about Frederick Douglass than what we already know?
Yes. Yeah, so the first lesson is really about connecting the themes of resistance to students' own lives. And so one of the things that I think, again, pushing back against this, we just need the facts, right? That sort of idea is that, we need, as teachers, we need to engage students. And if they don't see history as relevant to their lives, they're not going to be engaged. And so particularly when we're talking about something, that happened over 200 years ago, we want to make sure we're drawing out the themes and connecting them to our students' lives. So basically what this the first lesson does is it takes an excerpt from Frederick Douglass's famous narrative, and it pulls out a couple of themes from that narrative that students can take and write their own narrative about their own life. So defying a time when they defied an unjust authority, right, where may have been a parent or a teacher or an administrator, in some case an employer or a police officer, acting when they've acted on behalf of someone else, when they've worked collectively to make things better. So what this activity does, both it gives them some of the skills of looking at a narrative and kind of pulling out some of the key aspects of narrative writing, and then being able to apply the themes of Douglass's narrative to their own life. I mean, obviously, it's going to be impossible for students to fully understand, and for us in general, to fully understand the conditions and people's lives that prompted them to, you know, like someone like Frederick Douglass to rise up against the slave system. But I think, you know, we can get a little taste of that by digging into our own experiences and trying to see some of the themes that we might have seen in our own lives. And so that's what the first lesson tries to do.
And so, you know, looking at that too, and I would love to spend the time really getting into all 10 lessons, but I want to highlight some of the ones that I just jump out of me. But I'll go, you know, so lesson two, poetry of defiance, how the enslaved resisted. Lesson three, if there is no struggle, teaching a people's history of the abolition movement. Now, lesson four here. Who fought to end slavery? Meet the abolitionists. So you mean to tell me there's another abolitionist other than Frederick Douglass?
Right. Okay. And it, you know, just these.
And I mean, that's the heart of this chapter, of this lesson, right? Is this idea of going, hold on a minute, where there are key figures, but did you know?
Right. And so I, you know, just to highlight a couple of those that you just pointed out. I think lesson two is really essential because one of the things that lesson two does is talk about how enslaved people resisted from day one, right? And all the different ways that enslaved people resisted. And sometimes, you know, there's things that we don't think about as resistance, and students certainly don't think about as resistance, like singing songs while they work. But in fact were, because they slowed tempos, so they didn't have to work at their master's pace, right? They put hidden messages into the songs that they sang about how to escape up north. And so lesson two tries to highlight and celebrate that resistance, because so often I think slavery is taught as this horrific ordeal, which absolutely it was, but see black people as victims rather than as people who resisted.
Actively resisting that oppression,
right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And so that's what lesson two does. And then lesson three through five are really about highlighting the abolitionist movement, because this is often absent or a footnote in most curriculum. But the abolitionist movement was the movement that sets the pace for all social movements in the United States that come after it. It's often taught as a small handful of radicals, when in fact it was quite a substantial movement, right? I think the American Anti-Slavery Society, which was the largest abolitionist organization, had something like 3,000 chapters across the country, right? So imagine today, right, if the Black Lives Matter movement had 3,000 chapters across the country, people actively meeting, discussing, organizing, that was the scope of the movement. And what we do in those lessons, you know, the one you highlighted, Meet the Abolitionist, tries to familiarize students with, you know, the names and biographies of all the myriad of abolitionists and some of the debates. But then also lesson three, they actually sit around as abolitionists. They come up with their own biography as an abolitionist, and they debate the questions that the movement debated. And, you know, all sorts of questions that come up again a lot in the civil rights movement, right? Nonviolence versus violence. Should we support the emerging women's movement? Should we just focus on slavery in the South or also focus on racism in the North, right? So these questions that the abolitionist movement debated have a lot of relevance for today, social movements today and learning the key debates throughout anti-racist movement throughout history. So that to me is one of the most essential lessons, because students actually get to take part in the debates that the abolitionists took part in. And in doing so, they can kind of see themselves as activists debating these key questions.
So, and you know, so then we, you know, moving on, I just want to, because again, we want to get through, but this idea of the slave economy, the election of 1860, a war to free the slaves, and then who freed the slaves. I mean, what's happening there?
So starting in lesson six, what we really are trying to get students to grapple with is how entrenched the economy of slavery was to the entire nation.
Okay.
And this is so essential for understanding Lincoln's election and why he takes quite a conservative approach at the beginning of his presidency, because the North was deeply embedded in the slave economy. We have throughout the book, you know, I should say, what we've done is take what are essentially academic texts and make them accessible to students, to high school students. So one of the we have a primer on the abolitionist movement, which is, you know, one of the insane things I realized when editing this book is that there's no high school friendly text that I could find on the abolitionist movement, not a single history of the abolitionist movement that was high school friendly. So we created one.
Right. The question, you know, is there any social studies textbook that's actually got any really good stuff in it? I mean, other than if we start looking at the Rethinking School stuff. I mean, it's I don't want to go down that role, but I mean, criticizing the American textbook itself is a very legitimate issue. But then once you criticize that, I think what you're saying then is then you're left with very heavy academic texts, which then says, okay, now the teacher has to do that most of the times. And so this is, again, the importance of the book, because you and Bill and the other authors and as the editor have taken that really deep academic text and brought it back down and said, here's how you use it in a classroom.
Right. And it turns out a lot of historians and journalists, when you approach them and say, hey, you know, I'd love to make your text more accessible to high school students, they say, wow, that's amazing. You know, and because I think they, you know, they write it for an academic audience, but they often hope that it'll filter down, but don't really, you know, they're not teachers, and so don't have the sense of how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, back to lesson six, you know, the reason I brought that out is one of the, you know, phenomenal books that was put out by three journalists in the last decade or so is this book, Complicity, How the North Prolonged and Profited from Slavery. And so we took an excerpt from that and turned it into a lesson where we have students, you know, really kind of physically map the economy in the classroom and the connections between the South and the North and the West. And then they read an excerpt from Complicity, which, you know, the excerpt starts, points out with the fact that the New York City mayor, when the South seceded, went to the city council and said, you know, we should secede with them because New York's economy and Wall Street in particular was so invested in the slave economy, that you had huge support for the Confederacy in these places that are thought of as, you know, the anti-slavery North.
Well, right, it's the free North and the slave South, right? And then that's the oversimplicity again that we continue to portray to students instead of the complexity of looking at, as you just said. I mean, this underlying current of, you know, money, capitalism, particularly. You know, I'll go there and say, you know, we can really start to look and say, I mean, you know, what is the influence of money? Okay, while there were, quote, there wasn't slavery in the North, boy, there were people making a lot of money in the North off of it.
Exactly, exactly. And if you look in the economy in the West, right, which becomes key to the kind of coalition that Lincoln formed to get elected, what you had is a lot of small white farmers who did not want to be in competition with large slave plantations. And so you have a place, you know, where I taught in Portland, Oregon for a very long time. You have a place like Oregon where black people were just barred from the state. And so you have, along with this anti-slavery sentiment, this anti-black sentiment. So that's key to understand the election of 1860, because the coalition that Lincoln put together to get elected was against the expansion of slavery, but was not against slavery, particularly where it existed. And in fact, in many cases, benefited from slavery where it existed.
Right.
And so that's key to understanding why Lincoln, in his first inaugural speech, is saying, you know, is trying to make all these overtures to the South. And in fact, said that he will support an original 13th Amendment, which would have made slavery legal, or would have made it impossible for the federal government to touch slavery where it exists until 1900. And Lincoln, in his first inaugural speech, says he'll support this amendment if the South would just stop seceding and come back. But of course they don't,
right,
and the Civil War begins.
So then we're 8-9, you know, and now 8-9, was it a war to free the slaves? And then the other question, well, who freed the slaves?
Right. and so lesson eight really examines this question: was the Civil War a war to free the slaves? And I think, you know, the caveat about that is, I think a lot of people, there's this whole kind of right wing notion that the war was not about slavery at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, that's obviously hugely problematic. If you look at any of the secession documents,
right,
the South makes
very clear,
right, for us, it is about slavery. Sure, it's about states' rights, and the right that we're most concerned about
is our right to own slaves, darn it.
People, right?
Yeah.
So the South makes it very clear for them that it is a war to protect slavery. The question that Lesson 8 looks at is, what is the North fighting for? And that is more complicated. What Lesson 8 does is it looks at two documents, the Lincoln's first inaugural address, which we've talked about, and then what is probably the most famous document that no one ever reads is the Emancipation Proclamation, which is
Hey, that my job. My job was to know that that was the document. My job wasn't to read it.
Right,
I know
right.
My role as a student. My job is to repeat back the Emancipation Proclamation freed the slaves, Mr. Sanchez.
Right, exactly. And that is the common sense notion of what the Emancipation Proclamation did. And so what we do is we take students through a close reading of it, because it actually is a lot more complicated than
right.
that, right? What the Emancipation Proclamation document says is basically, South, we're going to give you 3 months, right? And in those 3 months, if you don't come back to the United States, we are going to declare the enslaved people in the places that are still rebelling in 3 months free. We're going to declare them free.
Right.
And then it has this long list of places that are exempt from the Emancipation Proclamation, right? Because Lincoln wants to be really clear, you know, these places are not in rebellion. They do have enslaved people,
right?
And it says, you know, for you got you all who are exempt, you know, should look at this document. It's left precisely as if this proclamation were not issued.
So, example state Maryland, right?
Right. Right. And it goes through all these parts of Louisiana, Arkansas, Texas, right? Places that either the Union had already occupied, or they were border states. Although some border states had already had some sort of emancipation decrees or various negotiations that they went into beforehand. But I think this is just such a key document for students because it's really about how the war evolves mm-hmm. into an anti-slavery war.
Right.
Right. Because this is and there's a lot of, you know, complicated analysis of, you know, why Lincoln gives the Emancipation Proclamation in the way that he does. And it's worth, you know, getting into some of that with students. But I think, you know, a key question that a lot of students raise is, okay, well, if this is the document that supposedly freed the slaves, why doesn't it just say, okay, all enslaved people are free right now?
Right.
And why does Lincoln make these kind of hedges? And Lincoln, you know, and part of it is understanding Lincoln's war strategy, which from the beginning, you know, he said over and over again, this is a war to reunite
the Union, right?
Not a war that has, you know, and he has this great quote that we get into later with students that, you know, if I could, reunite the country without freeing a single slave, I would do it. If I could reunite the country with freeing all the slaves, I would do it. It's a secondary concern for me.
Right.
And Lincoln, you know, does change. And by the end of the war, you know, by 1865, it's clear for him that you cannot win this war without freeing enslaved people. But those two documents are key to understanding how Lincoln moves. And then the last kind of main lesson before we have students write about what they've learned is lesson 9, which asks the question, who freed the slaves?
Well, I wanted to bring back, you know, we're getting close here. And so that this idea of who freed the slaves, because I think you want to bring this back because, you know, there's the Emancipation Proclamation, there's Lincoln's shift, and it's still focusing on policy and documents and leaders and things like that. But the reality is that how did that document and how did Lincoln get that place? And so who did free the slaves?
And that is a question I do not want to answer for students.
Right.
I want students to grapple with and think through themselves. And so what we actually do is, you know, we have an evidence wall in my classroom that has this question. And throughout the unit, students are grabbing quotes or grabbing evidence and they're throwing it on the wall. And then they come up with their own ideas. But the lesson 9, what it does is it puts a laser focus on the Civil War, because this is a key time to understand how Lincoln shifts and really how the country shifts, because there's a major shift in public opinion as well. It's not just Lincoln's shift that's happening as well, and particularly in the North. And so how does that shift occur? And so here, what we've done is we take really short excerpts from how a bunch of different historians have answered this question in different ways. So we have two different historians who focus on Lincoln in very, very different ways, right? McPherson, who says, yes, you know, despite all this, Lincoln still deserves credit,
right.
James McPherson, and Lerone Bennett, who wrote this, you know, incredible 1968 essay for Ebony, was Lincoln a white supremacist, which takes a much more critical view of Lincoln. And we want students to grapple with both of those. But then maybe even more importantly is we have a number of short excerpts around different actors and what they are doing during the Civil War. So one excerpt from Vincent Harding, historian Vincent Harding, on enslaved people in the Civil War. From his book, There is a River. And he makes these amazing metaphors about just the kind of the rapid flow, the river of black runaways during the Civil War that kind of forces the question of what to do with these people who are freeing themselves, mm-hmm. right? And then we have an excerpt from Manisha Sinha, who wrote this, you know, amazing book on the abolitionist movement around abolitionists in the Civil War and some of the actions that they were taking, particularly to kind of push Congress and Lincoln and Northern public opinion to turn the Civil War into a war against slavery. And then also the role that black soldiers played,
okay.
Right? Because
right,
once
I'm glad you brought that up.
Right, because once the Emancipation Proclamation does take effect, the Union Army is open to black soldiers. And I think this is maybe, you know, more than anything else, one of the things that just transforms public opinion, because black soldiers are, in many ways, you know, you could make the argument that the Union would not have won
without
black soldiers, and that the opening of the Union Army to black soldiers turns the tide of the war. And so a lot of students, you know, end up taking that, well, okay, if you couldn't have won the Civil War without black soldiers, then you couldn't have gotten freedom without black soldiers. So what we do in this lesson is get students to grapple with these various arguments before they decide what they think and write an essay around that question.
So we're at lesson 10, arguing the abolition, and that's the essay with an attitude. And so just give me a quick little glimpse what's happening there.
Yeah, so what I've done in this lesson, I mean, it's really that lesson 10 is a little bit more of a series of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
The other ones, I think, are a little bit more kind of a typical lesson plan that you can take and run with. What I try to do in lesson 10 is really make an argument to social studies teachers that we have to teach writing. I think a lot of times what I've seen is, especially in high school, the assumption is, you know, students know how to write an essay and teachers often just assign an essay. And so here's your topic, here's your question, maybe sometimes here's the document. You know, write an essay.
Okay, the old DBQ, document-based question. Use your document, use some evidence, put it in the right structure, and I'll give you a 4 out of 5 in the rubric.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
And so what I try to make a case to students, and I base a lot of this lesson on the amazing work of Linda Christensen, who's an English teacher who's written some phenomenal stuff, but in particular, her book Reading, Writing, and Rising Up has some amazing stuff about writing essays and how to teach essay writing. And so I've gathered kind of a lot of different ideas, some from her, some from stuff that just has worked in my classroom, for how both you can kind of spark students' ideas. The evidence wall that I talked about is in there, kind of getting them to talk back critically to children's books or their textbook, or, you know, there's this Scholastic elementary school lesson that I found about how wonderful President Lincoln is, you know, just a lot of things that help spark students' passion and get them to discuss the essay question and do some pre-writing before they jump in to writing the essay.
I love the idea of essay with an attitude. That whole idea just throws out writing for the rubric and saying, no, I want to see your passion, the way you put that, and talking, you know, put this in the context of abolition and the Civil War and slavery and who freed this and all these amazing lessons that you collected here, edited, along with other teachers and authors, Bill Bigelow, Brady Bennen, Deb Delman, Jessica Luvas, just an amazing collection here. We're not going to really get into, but you do the afterwards from Civil War to Reconstruction, and in fact, there is a lesson on the aftermath of the Civil War reconstructing the South. I want to get you possibly back, or even some other people from the Zinn Education Project, because they've really started pushing on this idea of Reconstruction. But Adam, that's a really important part too that we typically glance over. I'll give you like a little minute to just give us a hint about what's happening in Reconstruction.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what this book does is provide a firm basis for understanding Reconstruction, because what happens during the Civil War is a process, both through the abolitionist movement and through the actions of enslaved people, that continues and flourishes during Reconstruction. And Reconstruction is maybe one of the most mistaught, misunderstood time periods. And it's taught just like this kind of myth of Lincoln freed the slaves. It's taught from the top down, where you have really the important things that are going on during Reconstruction are the battles between the president and Congress during this time period. But really what the Zinn Education Project Teach Reconstruction campaign tries to do is reframe Reconstruction as a period of the first civil rights movement, of, you know, a black revolution that begins during the Civil War and continues throughout Reconstruction. And of course, you know, there's often focus on the backlash, which is, you know, in the KKK and that emerges, which is crucially important. But, you know, you would never teach the civil rights movement focusing on the Reagan presidency and the backlash in the 1980s, right? And, and that's often, I feel like, what we do with Reconstruction. We kind of skip over, you know, these years where black people are making tremendous strides in the South, rewriting the Constitution.
Elected. I mean, they're in the, you know, they're winning major elections in major state, you know, state Senate seats, House seats, all these things, right? You know,
exactly.
Yeah, and instead, though, it's like Civil War, boop, Reconstruction, and then Civil Rights era. And yeah, it's this missed opportunity. But hey, Adam, so teaching a people's history of abolition in the Civil War, rethinking schools. If I'm a teacher, if I'm a parent, I want this book. Where do I go?
So you can go to rethinkingschools.org.
Okay.
It's the best pay to buy, best place to buy it is straight from the publisher.
Great. So there it is, rethinkingschools.org. It's teaching a people's history of abolition in the Civil War. Great lessons, Adam. Great interview. If you're out there listening and if you're not a teacher and if you're not a parent who's not moved to say, I now need to reimagine what I even me. How about that as a parent out there going, holy crap, I need to reteach myself abolition in the Civil War. What a great contribution just to put this out there. And Adam, we end every show, but you, and by saying this, you truly have busted pencils. So thank you for coming on the show, man.
Thanks for having me.
Time now for our weekly salute to legendary historian and activist Howard Zinn. This is your moment of Zinn.
The country, therefore, was not born free, but born slave and free, servant and master, tenant and landlord, poor and rich.
My thanks to Adam Sanchez and Rethinking Schools, particularly for providing us the awesome content and authors. I'm Dr. Tim Slecker. Thanks for busting pencils.
Log on to BustedPencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk, Busted Pencils Radio.